Think it should work?
Let's see.
All right. Well, Giacomo promised me that he was going to warm up the crowd for me. I believe you have successfully fulfilled that promise, though now you've given me a bit of a time crunch, so I'm going to see if we can get through this. I'm Jameson Lopp. I've been doing Bitcoin and crypto asset security for a little over 3 years now, 3 years at BitGo, and now for 4 or 5 months at Casa. And really what I want to try to do today is just do a general brain dump of a lot of the concepts that I've come to believe are important, that anyone who's building systems that are basically protecting private keys should be thinking about. So just going to give you a lot of design principles and ideas that hopefully you can ingest and use whenever you decide to build one of these systems. So if you've been in this space for long at all, then you're well aware that there's a lot of risks. There's risks to trusting third parties. This is something that we are always fighting against as various entities are trying to centralize aspects of this system. And really, I think the next problem, once we have successfully pushed back against trusted third parties, is recognizing that users securing their own keys, their own assets, it costs a lot of time and money for users to do this. They have to deal with a lot of headaches because users are not security experts. And as a result, we have a lot of different types of losses. And Chainalysis is estimating around 4 million bitcoins have been lost, and at least 2 million bitcoins have been stolen. And these numbers are actually probably higher in reality because, at least with the stolen number, that's mainly looking at well-known publicized hacks of like centralized services. There's no way to really keep track of all of the different individuals that have lost money. So there's some issues here. For much of human history, we have seen this structure of our society evolve in a way where we are using specialists and we are outsourcing a lot of pieces of our lives to specialists because it allows us to be more efficient. But the problem here, of course, is that we're generally coming to trust these third parties. And as a result, a lot of users are fairly lackadaisical with regard to both their digital and physical security. And I'm seeing this resulting in people trusting their Bitcoin and other private keys to third parties. So I think that a lot of people are not really keeping self-defense at the top of their mind, usually because they just don't think that they're much of a target. And they may be correct, but as I've found personally, you can not be a target for your entire life and then become a target in a fairly quick, unexpected fashion. And as a result, we see from having these systems that are basically creating liquid bearer assets, the attackers tend to have different profiles than we see in you know traditional real-world situations. So attackers are seeing this as like a juicier target because if they can get away with it, it's you know less likely that they're going to be caught. And this actually creates a bit of a problem at a meta level because if a lot of people are failing to secure their own assets, it's almost like a herd immunity type of problem. I think that that's going to invite more and more attackers, and I'm particularly interested in seeing the evolution of what's happening with physical attacks in this space because from my perspective, it seems to be accelerating, and I think we should all try to help each other out by helping ourselves first and trying to disincentivize these types of attacks. So if you're building these types of systems, there are some high-level types of attacks and defenses that you need to worry about. We really have to build this software with the assumption that the average user is going to put minimal effort into securing their own assets. And we need to do everything that we can to be proactive about helping the users help themselves and help educate them. So, you know, with physical theft, that's a pretty well-known problem humans have been dealing with for the entire sum of human history. Digital theft is also easy to fix. All you have to do is take it off the internet. You know, we have hardware devices that make it fairly easy to do that these days. Physical disaster, that's really just an IT problem. But of course, most people are terrible at doing good IT practices. So we need to try to help people automatically have redundant storage. The bigger problem, I think, long term, of course, is going to be social engineering, and that's where education comes in. Basically, helping users understand that they are constantly under threat of being hacked, not just in a digital sense, but having their brain hacked by social engineers. And of course, collusion, that really comes down to like having trusted third parties and really minimizing the trust in these systems. So if we're talking about private keys and how we're managing them, there is, of course, an infinite number of different ways you can set this up. But traditionally, if it's just the user holding a key, there's a lot of different problems. They can get malware that steals it. They might have a weak password that gets brute forced. They can be coerced, of course. We heard about the like $5 wrench attacks. The death of owners, end-of-life issues is something that a lot of people have not thought about. Big fan of Pamela Morgan and her book that she put out recently, talking about these issues. I learned a lot from it myself. Of course, data loss, just due to bad IT practices. Forgotten password, of course, and another type of data loss. And phishing, of course, the hacking of the brain is always going to be a problem. Or if we go the other route where the service is custodial, has the keys, they could also get malware and viruses. They are actually creating juicy targets where they're creating a honeypot where hackers only need to go get in through one door to get a lot of money rather than a lot of different doors. Insider theft, once again, a trust issue. Fractional reserve, we saw that with Mt. Gox and possibly some other services. You don't know what's happening if you can't audit it. Government seizure hasn't seemed to be a big problem yet, but you never know. Data loss should not be as big of a problem, presumably, if there's an entire team of people that are managing it, but still a possibility. And of course, confiscation by the service, and this is happening pretty often at a lot of the AML KYC places that are arbitrarily seizing people's accounts and requiring them to provide all kinds of outrageous information to get their money. And even phishing can happen on the enterprise service side. In fact, at BitGo, we saw some of the most sophisticated spear phishing attacks against our own employees that I've ever seen in my entire career. So it's just because you're creating those honeypots. Attackers are going to put a lot more effort into it. Now, if we take this to the next level and turn it into like a two of two situation, we can start to get rid of some of these weaknesses because you've got two different parties and they're kind of watching each other's backs. But you see, there's a lot of stuff that we still haven't fixed, mostly around data loss. And that's because we don't really have much redundancy. Now you have a situation where with either one of these parties screws up, then you can potentially lose access to the assets. So I think the next logical step is, well, you give the user multiple keys. So this allows the user to be in full control. They are the custodian. They're not using a third party as a custodian. They're just using a third party as sort of a service provider, a facilitator. And that third party can provide different functions around recovery and around preventing things like fractional reserve from happening, because in a situation like this, the user can actually audit what's going on because the wallets are segregated rather than all pooled together. And really, fundamentally, while we can't 100% solve all of these problems, we're bringing down the risk quite a bit. But the main risk that is going to still be there, of course, is phishing on both sides. So from a high-level objective standpoint, of course, we want to get rid of third parties and attackers. But one thing that I'm going to try to push here is that I think that the user is their own worst enemy in these systems. And a principle that we had at BitGo, which I thought worked pretty well, was that it's preferable for the user to temporarily get locked out than for an attacker to get in even momentarily. And what I think that we should do when we're engineering these systems is actually flip it. Personally, I have seen far more users lose access due to negligence than I have seen them lose access due to an attacker stealing money from them. And of course, if we look back to that first slide, those estimates, which you could argue about how accurate they are, tend to suggest that data loss is probably a bigger problem than attackers. But especially, when we're getting to the point now where we do have a number of options in these systems where we've pushed the security out to the edges and the users have more sovereignty, then I think that they're more likely to experience loss due to their negligence. So how do we actually build a Bitcoin bank? Well, if you've ever used Bitcoin, it's pretty familiar. All you have to do Step one, write down that 24-word seed phrase and keep it safe. This probably seems normal to most of us who have operated in the system, but from an outsider, this is actually kind of insane. I mean, it's like saying, here, have some radioactive material, put it in a safe place. I mean, a safe place, what normal person really knows like how to properly store even a small amount of digital data? I mean, we've opened up a whole can of worms with this very simple suggestion that a lot of wallets give you when you're first initializing them. I think that we can agree that, at least outside of this room, there are very few security experts who know how to properly manage this system. So I'm actually going to consider this a fail. And this may be a bit controversial, but I believe that we won't really be able to get to a level of mainstream adoption if we are requiring people to keep even small amounts of data perfectly safe where they have no recourse if they don't have great IT practices. And here's an interesting thing, and I'm not trying to like rag on Trezor or anything. This is really part of a thesis that we have at Casa that, you know, if a user should not be entrusted to be managing and manipulating raw private keys by hand, then logically it doesn't really make any sense that we should be requiring users to hold on to the seeds, which are really the roots to all of these keys. And, you know, just a few days ago we saw this phishing attack against Trezor users that was trying to exploit this vulnerability. And last I heard, it's not clear if this was like a DNS poisoning or BGP attack or whatever. It doesn't really matter. The point is that we're in a phase now where we have fairly secure hardware. And so this proliferation of secure hardware has made it more obvious that the weakest point is, in fact, the user. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to get rid of the user out of these systems. I've tried it for my entire career, but the user just keeps coming back and managing to find new vulnerabilities to create. So I actually, there's a number, well, probably even an infinite number of ways that you can store and recover data. And it's only really limited to your imagination. At Casa, we've actually created a fairly easy-to-use wizard where the user can rotate the keys in their wallets. And this works well due to the multi-sig, multi-device, multi-location aspect of our Vault product that we've set up. There's also another seedless account recovery that I'm aware of. The Edge wallet has a setup, which is basically a two-of-two scheme where you have a key that is sent to your email, and then you have another key that is encrypted and on the Edge servers, and the way that you decrypt it is through account recovery questions that you have to answer. And I would like to see a lot more work happening in this space. I can give you a little preview here of like the way that it works in Casa. So basically, you go in, you hit a device, you mark it as compromised because you've lost it, and then you begin the process. You go buy a new Trezor, you plug it in, we get the XPub off of there, so we now have the new set of public keys that we're going to rotate your wallet over to. And once we have that new set of public keys, then you see we need to transfer the funds. So you select the account that you want to rotate, and you then just have to start adding signatures. This is a 3 of 5 multi-sig scheme. This, in reality, would take a lot longer because your hardware should be geographically separated. But once you have added all of your signatures, let's see, this should be the second signature, and then add the final signature, you will have a fully complete and valid Bitcoin transaction that you can then broadcast, and due to testnet, of course, always having fun time. You then have to duplicate that process for any account that you have, but it should be a lot more simple than having to go dig out private key, seed phrase from somewhere that you may have issues with how you've stored it, how you've recovered it. This entire process allows you to visualize fairly seamlessly a way to recover your private keys without ever having to like physically touch any of that sensitive data. And I think, you know, this is an interesting first step towards allowing users to operate in a system like this without having to touch the private keys. there's a lot of people out there who say, oh, well, it's so easy, just create a paper wallet, send your money to it, and you're good to go. But we've seen a lot of people lose money in paper wallets. It's hard to generate those private keys securely. Also, if it's an unencrypted paper wallet, you're suddenly physical attackers could easily get it and sweep your wallet. Paper wallets are not particularly robust against environmental disaster. And then there's also this weird edge issue that some people have hit, where if it's a paper wallet with a single private key, sometimes people will load that into their digital wallet and create a transaction that only sends part of the value, and then the rest of the value gets sent to a change address. And that change address isn't actually, the private key isn't stored anywhere, and then they don't understand what's happening, they throw it away, and they have accidentally lost the vast majority of the money in that wallet. Metal wallets are better. They still have the physical attacker problem if they're unencrypted. They are more robust against environmental factors. A month from now, I'm going to be publishing an in-depth stress test of all of the popular metal wallets. It's going to be interesting to see how they stand up. I actually managed to get access to a 20-ton hydraulic press, so I really mean stress test when I say stress test. And then the improper transaction construction is not a problem if you're putting down a whole seed phrase, but there are some metal wallets where people just put a single private key on them. So really, we need more redundancy. Once we've succeeded in protecting the users from trusted third parties, it becomes more of this redundancy IT problem where we're just trying to keep the users from losing their own keys. Users should not be relied upon to perform even the most basic IT practices, and so we need to help them do that. And I think we can all agree that five RICs are better than one. So this was my personal solution before we started doing Casa. I would basically have to spend an entire day every year doing this, where I would get an air gap computer, I'd create a Veracrypt partition that I generated with an insanely long randomly generated passphrase. I then put all my private key data into that, basically all the recovery data that was necessary for my heirs to know. Then I'd use Shamir's secret sharing scheme to take that insanely long decryption passphrase and shard it into an M of N setup based upon how many heirs I had and how much redundancy I wanted. And then copy this encrypted file onto N different USB drives and put a text file with the one Shamir shard on that drive for that person. Along with a text document, of course, of the instructions, hand out these USB drives in Faraday bags to each of my executors, and update annually to protect against bit rot. Now, then, of course, the process of writing down and testing the entire instruction set was what took up even more of my time, because if you don't test it, you're almost guaranteed to have a failure. And this is because complexity is the enemy of security. And when we're thinking about end-of-life issues especially, we need to realize that these applications that we're creating, we're not just creating them for the people who are in this room, the enthusiastic early adopters who are probably pretty nerdy and are willing to put a fair amount of effort into making these things work. We also need to make sure that our heirs can navigate these systems, because they're going to be pretty upset if you get hit by a truck and they can't access anything. So, how to actually build a Bitcoin bank or a crypto castle is this concept that I came up with after I actually submitted the talk. Using some of these basic building blocks of air gapping to protect you from the digital attackers, and hardware devices are good at that. Using strong crypto and multi-sig as basic building blocks to add redundancy and also add more layers of protection against someone who might get a single key. Hardware managers, protected by pins, making it very difficult for someone to get at those private keys as well. And then the wallet software really being this overarching gatehouse, if you will, managing all the different complexities of what's going on under the hood, trying to abstract away the complexities to bring some usability, user-friendliness into it. Automated alerts are also helpful so that people don't have to be constantly checking on the status of their wallets. And duress kill switches are something that I think we could also use some more investigation and development in. And so we're actually in the design phase of better duress switches at Casa. And we're just thinking about ways that we can leverage the software that is now available on mobile devices. And this especially is interesting if you start looking at some of the improved object detection and facial expression detection software that you can get out there. We're even thinking about playing around with potentially developing a way that you can, you know, facially signal to your wallet that you're under duress. Like, imagine being able to blink an SOS, or, you know, stick out your tongue or flare your nostrils or something like that, in a way that you could, even if you're under duress with a physical attacker right in your face, they would not really be able to say, oh, you just, you know, disabled your wallet. But that's you know, more of a long-term thing. So trust minimization, of course, is a big deal if we're trying to build systems where we're using third parties, but we don't want them to be trusted. Because you know, us building a team enables us to come together and build software at a pace that wouldn't be possible if we were all just working on little things by ourselves. But the problem is you can easily centralize it in a way that makes failure scenarios much more likely. So really what we're trying to do is make a balance between like low trust and convenience versus high trust and convenience. And by pushing the security out to the edges, I think that we can allow for untrusted third parties to help facilitate bank-like relationships where we are providing financial services without actually being custodians. And that's important when you can actually do things like having a key on a device that you are then physically or you're cryptographically signing data with that gets stored on the server, so that you can actually be protected against insider attacks if a hacker manages to get into that third-party server and screw with the data. As long as you have integrity checks and like signatures on that data that are checked on the client side, then you can throw up alarms and basically shut down any operations before you get deceived by whatever data is on that third-party service. And of course, as several people yesterday noted, I think that a full-stack integration where you can have a node or a miniature server running at home in your own trusted environment is going to be something long-term that we're going to see a number of people try to work on and hopefully, you know, get plug-and-play going. So Bitcoin is this new paradigm. It throws a lot of users for a loop because they've been conditioned to trust third-party specialists to fix whatever problems have happened in the system that they're using. You know, you lose your password, you get it reset, you have a fraudulent charge, you have someone step in and basically reverse it for you, but not so much in this system. So if the average user is not going to read the manual, they're not going to make any sufficient effort to try to secure their own data, then we need to do what we can to build guide rails to kind of force the user to go through educational processes. And really what we're trying to do at Casa is do that in a user-friendly visual format where we're actually trying to visualize the security in real time, or at least as well as we can, to let people have a better understanding of what's going on with their wallet. And of course, once again, we come back to the hacking of the brains, is that people are going to get tricked. You can't save everybody, even with the strongest, you know, technical back-end security. But there are some things that you can do. And one thing that I've seen in some wallets that's very helpful is if you're sending a large amount of money, just have a little pop-up that says, hey, this is a lot. You should not be pasting this address in from your clipboard. You should be calling up or using out-of-band communications to verify the address manually with the recipient to make sure that it's actually going where you want. I'm also interested in seeing check lock time verify get used more, because after all, if you're cryptographically prevented from spending your money, then you can't be socially engineered out of it. This does pose a few trade-offs, though, if you're trying to implement it with a multi-sig system, because it becomes an issue if your funds are all locked up, but then you've lost a key or two and you need to do a recovery. So I'm hoping that we can figure out some ways to do sort of like a graceful degradation of multi-sig, where we say, okay, we're locking it up for the next year, but we can degrade from 3 out of 5 to 2 out of 5 after a year, and from 2 out of 5 to 1 out of 5 after a couple of years if nobody is touching this money. Really, whatever makes the user comfortable. This, of course, gets more complicated on the technical side. I'm hoping that MAST or something like that is going to be able to make these more complicated scripting solutions possible and also more private. And malware blacklist. So blacklist, you know, is a loaded term. A lot of people get triggered by this, but we actually successfully implemented malware blacklist at BitGo, where what we were doing is going out and finding all that clipboard malware that's just listening for addresses and swapping it out with the attacker's addresses. And whenever we saw a transaction that was going to one of those addresses, we would just refuse to co-sign it. And we managed to save tens of thousands of dollars from going into these malware authors' pockets. And then finally, long-term solutions. I'm hoping to see more KYC, but by KYC, I mean know your counterparty. Better reputation features, basically. I think a lot of people here are well aware that we need better web of trust / reputation systems that, a number of people are working on that. And of course, Bitcoin covenants, I believe they have actually been implemented on the Elements sidechain, and hopefully someday we will see those on the mainnet as well. So hopefully, if you're able to ingest a lot of these things, then you'll have a little bit better preparation for starting to build your own crypto castle and build crypto castles for the rest of the world. If we have any time, hopefully I can take some questions. Thanks.
Where were you getting the sources for those blacklists? Were you scanning Chrome extensions or?
I believe it was actually from Kaspersky and other security researchers that had looked into the binaries to find those addresses.
So you bought data from them or a blog post or something that listed the data?
They were posting their findings. Yeah, it was publicly available data.
Thanks for the talk. One question, you mentioned that you do kind of rotate the keys when some action or event happens. How about the privacy implications? I mean, if the user is going to think, okay, everything is okay, but then you forward all the funds to a single new address, did you made any thoughts about how to prevent the whole history or how to not hurt the privacy?
Yeah, so actually, I posted a blog about kind of the privacy features at Casa, and to be honest, if you want really good privacy, you should not use our solution. It's really meant to be more of a vaulting product with very low volume. So it's not going to be easy to obscure the UTXOs because we expect there's only going to be a handful of them in the first place. And also, whenever you're using a third-party service, even if it's non-custodial, if they're just facilitating stuff, it's very hard to have strong privacy because you have to interact with them. So the only way to get true strong privacy in these systems is to operate in a way that you're fully self-contained. You're running all of your software and hardware yourself and not interacting with any third parties who might know your IP address or your identity or what have you. So it's it's trade-offs, and really what we're going for is more convenience and security, and of course that is kind of at the expense of privacy. But you are more than welcome to sign up with us using a pseudonym and pay anonymously. It's just not going to be perfect privacy.
Thanks for the talk. It was super. I was just wondering if you'd seen any interesting solutions to recipient verification, because once you've optimized the storage and the transaction side, it feels to me like the weakest point for the funds is whenever you're making a transaction. And especially when you're sending to organizations, how do you ensure that the address belongs to those people without having to make a Skype call or a phone call or a video call or something like that?
Well, I think that at least the first time that you are sending a transaction to an entity, you should do some sort of out-of-band communication. Now, if you're then making multiple recurring payments, you can be pretty well assured that that address is going to continue to work. But it almost comes down to an identity problem once again, right? And so, these decentralized identity services that are popping up, some of them, or at least I believe on Blockstack, you can associate your Bitcoin address with your identity. So I would think it would have to be something like that, where you're actually tying the addresses to an identity that is at least somewhat immutable.
Thanks.
Great, thanks.